Great to have you with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we begin the show by talking about the book Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicine. Subtitle, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. And we have the author with us, Nicholas Money, fungal biologist, science writer, professor at Miami University in Ohio. His other books include The Rise of Yeast, How the Sugar Fungus Shaped Civilization, and another book, The Selfish Ape, Human Nature and Our Path to Extinction. So as we talk with Nick, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about fungi? Let us know how you notice it in fungi in your life. Maybe you love fermented food, for example, or you've noticed mold growing on the side of your house or on your shower curtain. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Nick Money, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, hi, Larry. Thank you for the invitation.
Tell you what, if you look at a title like Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, it doesn't inspire a ton of confidence. But I tell you what, I read your book, and I was laughing at times. There are some great stories some almost mind-numbing numbers about fungi, and at all a very pleasant read. So thank you so much for writing it.
It's always important to remember that it's one of the things that the author has very little control over is the title of the book. So,
well, I tell you what, it's a dandy read. You've got an interesting relationship with fungi yourself.
Absolutely.
Talk about how it played a role in something that happened maybe during your childhood. You talk about that right off the bat.
Yeah. It's all about me, isn't it? No, but there is a little bit of autobiography here in the sense that I grew up in the United Kingdom. I suffered from very severe childhood asthma, and it was only much, much later in life that I understood that fungal spores, that when we inhale them from the surrounding air, that this is one of the major causes of asthma. And there's a lot of very good clinical data on this. In looking at children that suffer from asthma and other kinds of allergies, and boy, they react to the little proteins carried on the surface of fungal spores, and that's what was happening to me as a kid. So my relationship with fungi, well, everybody's relationship fungi, extends all the way from actually before birth, from the womb to the tomb when we're decomposed by fungi. So yeah, there you go.
So, and here you are, you're a mycologist. As a mycologist, there are some unexpected places you've been asked to share your expertise. You mentioned in the courtroom, and it took me a minute to think about it, but how does a mycologist wind up in a courtroom?
That's a good question. That actually takes me back to the issue of fungal spores that are in the air. There is so much interest in the home contamination by molds that grow after water damage and the potential threat that they pose to homeowners. And so indeed, over the years, I've worked as an expert witness. I've worked with attorneys handling these cases. So there are lawsuits against homeowners. There are lawsuits against all kinds of things, rental companies, insurance companies. So, yeah, it's a very complicated issue legally. Scientifically, it's actually relatively straightforward.
Yeah. Fungi, so what are fungi? We haven't even...
That's right. Yeah, what are fungi? So fungi they're microorganisms, and that doesn't seem to actually ring true when you think about something as big as a mushroom, obviously not microscopic, but most of the organism, or rather for most of its life cycle... That mushroom-forming fungus exists in the form of these microscopically thin filaments that grow in the soil, and that's the colony or mycelium that's formed by the fungus. And so they're microorganisms to begin with. What else? They've got cells that are a lot like us in the sense that humans and other animals, we've got complicated cells where our chromosomes are stuffed inside nuclei. And so fungi are like that, and the technical term or the biological term is eukaryotes. So they're eukaryotic microorganisms. And the other thing that we can add to that, so they're not bacteria. They're also not plants. They don't make their own food. Like us, they absorb their food from by digesting the materials produced by other organisms.
And the spores they produce, I read somewhere, and I'm not sure where, that fungi produce about 50 megatons of spores per year, if you think about it on a worldwide basis. And that would be the equivalent of about 500,000 blue whales, which is the largest animal in existence.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, some years ago, I worked with some of the students in my lab. We were working on some of these looking at these high concentrations of spores in the atmospheres. But that is an amazing truth. It seems to be that there are indeed these vast quantities cumulatively of fungal spores circulating around the planet 24/7. And so, in fact, they reach densities in some areas, perhaps over forests that are supporting very high lots and lots of fungi, high diversity above grasslands, where they might even have an effect upon weather patterns.
God, it's amazing. You know, and I can think of some very highly regarded, you mentioned mushrooms, very highly regarded mushrooms, fungi like morel mushrooms. We're getting into the morel season here in Wisconsin. There are also some despised fungi like mold on food. How do you characterize the relationship between fungi and us humans?
Well, it's lifelong.
Yeah?
It's lifelong. It's unavoidable. So whether or not you go out and pick morels, you're going to be interacting with fungi every day of your life. And it's also really complicated. So we could talk about some of the fungi that actually grow on the body. So in the sense that even if you're not somebody that's interested in eating mushrooms or collecting them, hey, you're still interacting with them in a very intimate fashion all the time. They're moving through our digestive system. And this is part of the reason that I wanted to write this book. There has been so much concentration on, so much interest in, for good reason, in the microbiome that's dominated by these trillions of bacteria that move through the gut. But the fungi are really, really important in the health of our digestive system, too. And so that's part of what I'm doing in this book project.
And you do it very well. Well, you know, you do at one point in the book, fairly early, I think, as I remember it, you talk about conditions like ringworm and dandruff and athlete's foot, all caused by fungi. And let's talk about those conditions a bit. Ringworm, how long have we humans known about ringworm?
Yeah, ringworm's a really interesting story. So the fungus, there's actually a group of them that cause ringworm. I mean, they've been with us throughout our evolutionary history. And they're related. They're a fungi that cause athlete's foot. We're talking about skin infections here. And also, they've been with us since the get-go. What's fascinating there is if you look at where the greatest genetic diversity of these fungi exists, these fungi that infect the skin, and particularly the feet, the highest diversity is in Africa. Well, we see the same thing with human populations. So probably what happened is when we migrated from Africa to, you know, northern climates, we took the fungi with us. We started wearing shoes. We created a very unnatural environment by enclosing what we call the toe space in a closed shoe. It could be there that we'd really transformed these fungi that weren't causing any problems. They were just natural inhabitants. We call them commensals on the skin, and we turned them into a problem by changing the environment in which they were growing.
You know, dandruff, you write about what goes on your scalp, which was kind of amazing to read about, to be perfectly honest. There are plenty of yeast on our scalps, and they cause our heads to produce flakes.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? So in the area of a postage stamp, potentially there's millions of these fungi. Now, they're actually growing in the form of yeasts. So these are cells that produce buds on their surface. But they're all over the scalp, and they're feeding on the secretions on the scalp from our sebaceous glands. And yeah, indeed, if they grow in profusion, if they get too festive, this actually can exacerbate dandruff. And the best-selling dandruff shampoos contain antifungal agents. So if you're using, probably a product placement here,
Procter & Gamble,
Head & Shoulders, actually the best-selling shampoo in the world. It's got an antifungal agent, and that's how it's so effective at controlling dandruff.
But it comes back. I mean, the Head & Shoulders might get rid of it for a day.
Yeah, that's interesting. It seems that there are some European sources on this that say you're better off not washing your hair every day. You know, do it every few weeks and just use rainwater, and you'll never suffer from dandruff. But I'm not willing to try that experiment.
I'm not either. Well, you're right about that. We're always inhaling spores, and I think you say in the book, we come in contact with about a billion spores in our lungs when we inhale and exhale.
Huge numbers of spores. I mean, if you're outdoors, especially, I mean, probably every single inhalation and exhalation, fungal spores are moving in and out. And even though they're very, very tiny, our immune systems are reacting to them. And that's one of the ways in which we have this, I referred to it as an intimate relationship, but indeed it is with these microorganisms, these spores that are moving in and out of the lungs. We're also breathing them in through our noses. And of course, many of us are atopic. We're allergic to these spores, and they can cause, mentioned asthma, but also rhinitis, allergic rhinitis, another very common condition, and fungi play a role in that too.
Yeah. You say in the book, Roger Altunian, I believe, is your hero when it comes to
that. That's right. And I only learned about him fairly late in life, but yeah, he developed one of the best asthma medicines for controlling asthma that I actually was prescribed in Britain as a child, and it was very, very effective at actually dampening the symptoms of asthma. What's fascinating about this guy was a Syrian-born British immigrant. What's fascinating about him is that he was a severe asthmatic himself, and he carried out self-tests by inhaling different kinds of dusts to deliberately provoke really serious asthma attacks. I mean, he had to have a rescue medicine that he'd stab into his leg to bring him back from near death. An incredible story, but he absolute hero. And unfortunately, he died relatively young from the symptoms of asthma. It's fascinating guy.
Amazing story. Esty in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Esty. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. A friend watered my plants when I was away, my indoors plants. And when I came back, I found that she had watered them a little too much, and I had fungus gnats all over the house. And so I put a trap, which is basically a little cup with apple vinegar, and the gnats go there and find their death. But the interesting thing is that then each knot becomes a little circle of blue-gray mold. And unfortunately, I just dumped them in the toilet not that long, like an hour ago. So I would have sent you a photo, which you probably are aware what that is. But I've been wondering about these. They're really distinct circles, but they're all kind of stuck together. It's very interesting to look at that. So yeah. So if you can explain to me what's going on there.
Yeah.
I mean, so it tells you, I mean, just how many fungal spores are in the air, and particularly because your friend overwatered your plants maybe and really got them going. But those colonies then, they're formed from, I mentioned these microscopic filaments that spread out when a spore germinates. And so if you've got two or three spores maybe that land on a surface, they'll indeed grow together, but they always have that circular form because they grow outwards in all directions from that point source, that beginning, which is the spore, which is the sort of fungal equivalent of a seed. And you might not want to do this, but if you get a good hand lens magnifying loop and actually look at those little colonies, magnify it even 10, 15 times, they're gorgeous, they're beautiful. You can see these sparkling stalks and often multicolored. They're utterly, I find them inspiring. Well, I have for decades. Others might find them repulsive, but I love them.
Nicholas Money, our guest today, his book is titled Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. Questions or an experience to share, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our technical director. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks so much for joining us on WPR. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Nicholas Money. Nick is the author of Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. And questions, you can, well, our lines are filling up here, but you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org for sure. Tim and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Larry, it's a beautiful day today. I'm kind of curious how many spores are floating around out there. But my question has to do with in our homes, you know, like if you have a HEPA filter, you know, attached to your furnace filter, how does that clean out some of these spores that might be floating through your home?
Yeah, interesting. What do you think, Nick?
But that's a good question. It depends what kind of filter. The devil's in the details. But indeed, some of the stronger filters, higher rated filters, will indeed block a lot of the fungal spores. That the pore size, the holes in those filters are small enough that they trap the fungal spores, kind of like a coffee filter. The trouble is with those that if you install those on your, at least I found this in my home and at home in Ohio, the better the filter, the more restrictive the airflow. And so you're actually putting, giving you advice here, air conditioning advice here, HVAC advice. But indeed, you can have a really effective filter, but it might put a lot of strain on your HVAC system. But indeed, yeah, they are strong enough, or excuse me, the pore size is small enough to strain out a lot of the fungal spores.
There you go, Tim. Colette in Eagle River will give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. I live in Eagle River, and I really like looking at mushrooms and finding them out. And I'm wondering what you think of phone apps, because I use something called Picture Mushrooms. And, you know, it seems better than the book, because the books don't seem to, you know, they don't seem to ever have enough information or pictures, and it's hard to identify. And I've collected, not eaten, but collected and took pictures of like 384 different species up here between the different properties I have up here. And then if I do something that says it's edible and safe, I usually check it with other, not books, but usually other apps and double check in. What do you think of these apps?
So the apps are definitely getting better and better. That's absolutely the case. I'm kind of prevaricating here because I'm not going to advise anybody that isn't completely sure what they're picking to perhaps experiment with it, to actually eat it. But I mean, fungal identification in the field is very complicated. It's very difficult. I'm not very good at it at all. I've been more of a lab scientist than a field scientist, but I've certainly got colleagues that are just brilliant at this. Here we go. The best advice that I can give you is to get involved with a local group of mycologists. I know that there actually are a number in your state. And this is the best way to learn about fungi. Go and actually listen to some people that have been doing this for years. And, but,
and maybe go out in the field with them.
Absolutely. Go out and work, and there'll be presumably there'll be some of these events around the morel season that, as you said, is just coming up in the next few weeks. So yeah, that's my best advice. But I'm not going to knock the apps. Some of them are spectacular, and they work very well.
Yeah, and Colette, stay listening too, because Kevin Olson, who is with Northwoods Tea and Herb, based in Wausau, is going to be on after Nick is finished with us to talk about foraging. So he may have some additional. Kevin may have some additional comments as well. So stay listening. Paul in Darlington, we'll go to you. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Yeah, my question is on golden oyster mushrooms and how they've become invasive throughout Wisconsin, and I'm thinking other states as well. And whether you think if companies like the Field and Forest should be prohibited from selling golden oyster mushroom spore to customers?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that, but I mean there are a number of mushrooms that appear to be invasive, so they've been brought in various ways. But I hadn't thought about that. The fact that if companies are actually growing these, cultivating them, that their spores indeed will become established and produce those mushrooms in a particular area. That's really interesting. You know, you've taught me something this morning. I wasn't aware of that. I'll have to look into that. Yeah.
Thank you, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it. Terry called, couldn't stay with us. She's wondering why toenail fungus is so hard to get rid of. Apparently, Terry has had experience with this.
Yeah, indeed. So when you've got a fungus that's established in the toenail, I mean, it's deep. It's deep within those tissues. Sometimes it's in the nail bed. So even if you're removing the damaged parts of the toenail, the fungus is still there. Very, very difficult to treat. A lot of the treatments, if you go see a podiatrist now to be treated for that kind of condition, often they'll actually talk about an oral medication. So it's an oral antifungal that you have to take for quite a long period of time. So your body's really suffused with this medicine, and it's destroying the fungi, and very effectively will destroy the fungi involved in a toenail infection. But of course, the side effects of taking a medicine like that you're changing the body's relationship with the fungi that grow naturally on it and actually are good for our health.
Speaking of medical, Bob and Adams is wondering about the efficacy of fruiting bodies versus mycelium in medical mushrooms.
Yeah, well, I'm a kind of a heretic in this area, or considered so, because I'm not a big fan of the medicinal mushroom business. I've written a lot about this as an academic rather than a popular science writer. But my it's always show me the evidence, and I don't see the evidence for most of these products really having any useful effects. But the question that's asked here about the difference between the mycelia and the fruit body is a really good one. It's one way in which often a consumer doesn't really know what they're getting if they're buying a mushroom product. Are they really getting a powder made from a dried mushroom, or are they getting powders produced by the mycelia, the feeding part of the fungus? There have actually been a few studies done that compare the amount of these possibly active compounds in the fruit body versus the mycelia. In some cases, they're pretty much the same. In others, there are profound differences. So it's just one of the ways in which it's really, really difficult to get at the question of, you know, are mushrooms medicinal? What are we really talking about? What kind of a product are we talking about?
I think you mentioned in the book that one of your papers to that effect resulted in the journal receiving the largest number of comments, a lot of them negative about what you
absolutely were absolutely. I was actually, I've been threatened with other lawsuits. I was threatened with a lawsuit over that one too, and it's downloaded. I get emails too to this day. Some are very positive, saying thank you for saying this. I mean, the article was called "Are Mushrooms Medicinal?" It was a short review article, a commentary, but my essential conclusion was no. And so I also got a lot of negative feedback on that one. But hey, this is the way that science works. Let's provoke debate, and over time, the truth will out.
Well, you know, here we are in Wisconsin, and you spend a chapter talking about how molds and mushrooms are in our diet, and at Wisconsin Public Radio, we need to talk about beer and cheese, which you certainly do in the book. Let's go back to this Austrian salt miner who lived 2,600 years ago. That's a wonderful story you tell in the book.
Yeah, so indeed, an Austrian salt miner a long, long time ago, and he left deposits in the mine, right? So he pooped in the mine, and some of that material's been collected, and of course it's after all this passage of time, it's almost rock hard and dried out. But using these amazing techniques of genetic amplification, DNA amplification, there's been some beautiful work done to figure out what his meal was. What was he eating? And indeed, what they found was that he had certainly eaten blue cheese, some kind of blue cheese, because the remnants of that were in this fecal sample that was found in the cave. It's absolutely astonishing. And they know it's blue cheese because there are particular fungi that are involved in that fermentation, that formation of wonderful flavors and the veins in blue cheese. And hey, that fungus was there in his feces, and it couldn't have got there any other way. This isn't something that's very common in the environment. And there's a suggestion. The evidence here isn't as strong, but they also found evidence of beer yeast, maybe. So I've got this idea of this ancient gourmand, right? And he's taking a break from hacking away at the rock face in the salt mine, and he's drinking beer and eating blue cheese. And you know, hats off to him. He was,
and he's to say, not so different from what a gourmand today might partake of.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I love that. How long ago did humans start harnessing the power of yeasts to make beer?
Yeah, well, we can't be sure, but probably a very, very long time ago, in the form of natural fermentations that they observed. So my guess is, I wrote about this in an earlier book, that palm wine, so produced from the sap from a tropical palm tree, was probably the first alcoholic beverage that was brewed and consumed by a human, or possibly even some human ancestor, some hominid ancestor, because this is a very sugar-rich product. It's very high nutritional value. And if it's left out in the sun, it will naturally ferment. Yeasts arise, begin that process of fermenting this, which includes eventually the production of alcohol. So they would have had, it probably would have produced a strength around about the strength of a bottled beer. But that was probably the first evidence of this. Goes back, well, a long time, thousands and thousands of years, at least, you know, pre-agricultural revolution, pre the formation of any sedentary living on farms. So you got to go back 10,000 years. You know, there's actually evidence from the archaeological evidence that humans or some hominid was actually working with maybe making sorghum beer. Well, in Mozambique, 100,000 years ago. It's incredible. Take a while to get to that story, but...
And it is an incredible story. And then to the cheese, you tell a great story. Well, there's a tale about a shepherd, I think, who was in a cave. Tell that story and what you think of it.
So... Yeah, if you think about some very different flavorful French cheeses that are actually grown or produced in caves, and how did that happen? And there's this story about this herder that left his milk curds in a cave. He ran off in search of a maiden. That's the way that they tell this story. And you know, he came back days or weeks later, and the flavor had changed. And he'd created the first of these incredible cave cheeses. And something like that may well have happened.
But that's not the way it works these days.
No, I mean, absolutely not. So it's a highly regulated process today. Nothing is left to chance. But, you know, if you buy Roquefort cheese or one of the other great French blue cheeses, yeah, these are well, essentially high-tech products today. But they have a reliable flavor.
Well, we can get into a lot of trouble with some of our fungi. You tell a story of, Sasha Elterman.
Oh, indeed.
A tennis player, and how that relates to, it's a great story within your book.
Yeah. So she was a young athlete that suffered a head injury. These were at some in Israel, actually, and she developed this very, very rare brain infection, and she was treated successfully. She was finally cured, but to begin with, this was just a medical mystery. They had essentially a bridge collapsed, and these young athletes fell into the water. Well, that water was contaminated with a particular fungus, a thing called Scedosporium, and you can think about that water being forced into the nasal passages, and you're pretty close to the brain if you get up there. So some of the athletes actually developed these terrible infections of their central nervous systems. And so I certainly talk in the book, there's a chapter there about these very, very serious fungal infections that are actually growing in frequency. I mean, there's a World Health Organization suggests maybe 1.5 million deaths per year from fungal infections now. So it's the yin and the yang of our relationship with the fungi. There's all these positive aspects to our relationship and all many different ways in which the fungi support our health, but also particularly when we're injured in some way, or probably more importantly, or definitely more importantly in terms of numbers, when our immune systems are damaged, then we become really vulnerable. We become vulnerable to serious fungal infections that are very difficult to treat.
Grant emailed us, can you discuss the relationship between brewers and bakers while using the same yeast to make their two products?
Yeah, it's a big topic. I mean, historically, the idea is that we Homo sapiens started off brewing beer rather than baking bread. And there's one idea. We get no real evidence for this, but there's an idea that maybe in somewhere like Egypt, for example, probably in Egypt, where they were brewing beer, that there was this, I'll call it cross contamination, and the yeast that were being used to brew beer, or the yeast that was being used to brew beer, found its way into some bread dough, and then we saw that they saw this miraculous leavening of the bread dough. And I mean, bread was eaten long before that, but it was unleavened bread. So yeah, that relationship and probably began then, and then probably more deliberate. Hey, we're going to take a scoop of this foam from the beer vat, and we'll use this with our bread dough to actually create this product. And you can see in Rome, in Roman history too, the I'm going to use the word rise here. I'm trying not to, but the rise in interest in risen bread, in leavened bread. I mean, it was a sort of seen as a rather rude confection early on, but it took off, and then the Romans are eating it.
And I want to go back to cheese for a minute too, because cheese it's a useful way to store milk in a fashion. You know, we didn't have, well, talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So why did we begin to experiment? Why did humans begin to experiment with cheese and yogurt and other products like that? Well, the issue probably is shelf life. But milk doesn't last for long, and it attracts the growth of some rather dangerous bacteria. But yeah, you produce a hard cheese, and that thing will last for a long time. So again, particularly in northern climates, if you wanted something that would travel well, That's the perhaps the birth of these fermented milk products, and also the advantage. This is a complicated issue too, but in terms of our widespread lactose intolerance, that actually cheese has, you know, lower levels of milk sugar and is actually, some people, you know, couldn't possibly drink milk, but they're okay with certain cheeses.
We have, there are several aspects of your book that we haven't discussed by any means, but that several historical events that kind of intrigue me. The Salem witch trials might be linked to fungi.
Possibly by, the exposure to a toxin produced by a fungus so the young women, well, and others in Salem were exposed perhaps to contaminated rye flour that contained these mycotoxins that was responsible for their aberrant behavior. So, yeah, rather than sort of demonic possession, it was fungal possession. But,
That rye business or grain business has, you talk about how that affected like whole communities or great parts of certain communities.
Yeah, absolutely. So huge in terms of, you know, you read the book and look at lots of examples of the historical impact of these, they're called mycotoxins on humans, but they're with us today. I mean, every day we're exposed to small quantities of mycotoxins. The USDA and the FDA, they regulate the amount of these toxins in our food, but we can't avoid them entirely. They're in really everything that we eat. They're certainly in all kinds of cereals, but they're also in the food chain. If you're a meat eater, or even if you eat farmed fish, there's mycotoxins in those foods too. So again, it's another example of our, you know, this clear, profound, deep relationship with mycology.
And we you mentioned this kind of right away in the beginning of our interview, but your final chapter is a wider look at how fungi affect our ecosystems and our earth. I was going to ask you, how important are fungi to life and death on Earth? I mean, we wouldn't be here if we didn't have fungi.
No. It's impossible, because through the relationships between fungi and plants, so first thing is they, as I say, they spin the carbon cycle, very, very important. We'd be up to our necks in debris, you know, if it weren't for the activities of these decomposer fungi. But then also through their mycorrhizal interactions with plants, with trees, but other plants too, that by supporting plant life, well, we're dependent upon botany, and botany is dependent upon mycology. So there you go. Yeah, we wouldn't be here without them for a number of reasons.
It's a fantastic book. I tell you, I interviewed Merlin Sheldrake. I don't know if you know
him.
Oh,
great. Absolutely.
Merlin said he was going to take one of his books, wet the pages of it, inject some, I think it was pleurotic mycelia, which would eat up the book and leave oyster mushrooms, and he was going to then eat the oyster mushrooms, so he would be eating his book.
Yep, very cool. He had photographs of the book covered in these oyster mushrooms afterwards, so it was a I don't know if he went on and ate them afterwards. Why not? So, yeah, good luck to him.
Well, I tell you what, your book is very engaging, and I learned an awful lot, and I'm really glad you wrote it, and I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much, Nick, for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Me too. It was a real pleasure talking to you and the people that phoned in. Fascinating questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works. Nick Money, our guest today, and his book is titled Molds, Mushrooms, and Medicines, subtitle Our Lifelong Relationship with Fungi. It's fascinating and fun read, and you're going to enjoy it, that is for sure. Well, coming up, we're going to kind of continue on this path. I know mushrooms are going to come up for sure. We're going to talk about foraging to put great food on your table. Kevin Olson, our guest, coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio.